Indeed it isn't, Bazan agreed. Taking a sip from the steaming cup Dizelle placed in front of her. Sovereign Black had never been her favorite, but after so long without the taste of tea, it was quite wonderful. And all employees are automatically made shareholders, Madam went on. Yes, with current workers and managers all holding an equal number of shares. New workers, assuming we ever have the opportunity to employ any, will receive one share upon joining, to be increased by a share a year until they achieve parity with their colleagues. A cooperative, Madam said, setting the papers down and reaching for her own teacup. Quite so. A company where everyone shares in the profits and is thereby incentivized to generate more. And I should like you to run it. A novel proposal, and one I'll certainly consider. But I find it odd you would put this forward now, with the continuing emergency. I put it forward because of the continuing emergency. You'll find another document at the end of the bundle. I ask that you witness it. Madam leafed through the papers until she found it, her brows knitting in puzzlement as she read the opening paragraph. You appear to have written a will, she said. I have. There was a pre-existing will stored at Exceptional Initiatives headquarters, but I suspect it's ash by now. In any case, my wishes have changed since then. The list of beneficiaries is short, and I trust you will ensure they all receive the allotted bequests in due course. One typically puts one's affairs in order in the expectation of an imminent demise. Bazan pursed her lips in agreement. One does. Madam Hackigan sat back in her chair, eyeing Lizanne closely. The fact that you prepared a will indicates you expect the beneficiaries to survive, but you do not. Am I wrong? Rarely, I suspect. The director let out a soft, humorless laugh, shaking her head. It is my contention that you are far too valuable. Just sign it. Madam's gaze snapped up at the hardness in Lizanne's voice. She met the older woman's eyes, making sure she understood her resolve. After a moment, Madam reached for a pen, dabbed the nib in an inkpot, and added her signature to the document. Thank you, Lizanne said, taking a moment to drain her teacup. I have one more request before I go, regarding personnel. Personnel? Yes. I know you have compiled copious records regarding the prior occupations of our employees. I require one with a special set of skills. All those with military experience have been identified. Not military experience, Lizanne broke in. Theatrical. The little cut was too far away to hear the explosion, but the cloudless morning sky gave Lizanne a clear view of it. She watched through the front window of the Typhoon's gondola as a brief flash of white blazed in the center of the pass before a vaguely mushroom-shaped cloud began to rise above the mountains of the neck. The charges laid in the small cut exploded shortly after, and soon there were two tall mushrooms rising to east and west. The demolition crews, all experienced miners or road builders, had been dropped by Aerostat 3 days before, working with feverish energy to complete the task in the time available. Lizanne had yet to catch sight of any Reds, but knew their enemy must have seen the explosions. They know the only quick route now lies in the Grand Cut, she thought. But will they take the bait? It was possible the White could steer its army towards the coast road to the west, buying the Defense League valuable time in the process, but she had a sense it would try for the pass despite the obvious risks. What does it care about risks? It can always make more spoiled, at least for now. She held on to the central support strut as Tekela put the Typhoon into a steep descent, The other blood-blessed, 10 in all, including Morva, were crowded together in various states of white-faced nausea. For most, it was their first trip in an aerostat, and 3 of the blood-blessed from the Mount Works had never seen any kind of combat before. They all carried smoker carbines, and each had a spider on their wrist, fully loaded with product. In addition, they carried full flasks of red, green, and black, with an emergency vial of blue. It occurred to Lazan that with all the product on their person, those drafted into this mission might well be, albeit briefly, the richest group of individuals on the planet. "Get ready," Lazan told them as the typhoon leveled out. She peered through the rear window at the Tempest, the typhoon's recently constructed sister ship, into which another 13 bloodblessed had been crammed. The Tempest bristled with armaments, 2 thumpers on either side of the gondola with a growler at the rear, and another 2 in a fixed position at the front, which could be triggered by the pilot. The lookout in the upper gondola also had a mini-growler to ward off attacks from above. The Typhoon was armed only with growlers, thanks to the heavy object hanging beneath her gondola, which limited the weight she could bear and still maneuver. "Check your watch," Lazan told Morva, who obligingly extended her wrist to display her timepiece. Lazan placed her own watch alongside to ensure they were synchronized. "Start the trance in exactly 2 hours," Morva finished. "Remain in the trance until you contact me or the product runs out. I know." Lazan nodded in satisfaction and started towards the front of the gondola, pausing when Morva said, "It was my uncle, wasn't it? He made you leave me behind." There was no heat to her words, just careful observation. "My trance connection with you is stronger than with the others," Lazan replied. "Mrs. Griffin could have taken on the role." "Mrs. Griffin is insane. She's better off remaining on the viable." She met Morva's gaze. "You have this role because I trust no one else to do it." She returned to Takela's side, watching the approaching mountains. The morning winds were stiff, but she had been advised by Verestians familiar with the region they would grow fierce as the day wore on. The Grand Cut came into view as they flew over the southern foothills. Lazan found its appearance somewhat at odds with its name, a narrow, cliff-sided track tracing the contours between the flanks of 2 mountains. She took some solace from the photostats that showed the pass to be considerably wider to the north and, therefore, hopefully a more tempting option for whoever had command of the White's forces today. Takela, having made this trip several times over the preceding days, steered the Typhoon towards a broad ledge, jutting from a point 100 feet or so up the eastern mountain. Reconnaissance had revealed this as the optimum landing site, as there was a similarly proportioned ledge on the opposite side of the pass. Takela brought the aerostat closer, deft hands correcting their course as the fractious mountain air currents buffeted the craft. After a few minutes of careful handling, the Typhoon hovered over the ledge at a height of 20 feet. "Remember," she told Takela, "not until Morva gives the order, no matter what else might happen." Takela looked up at her, the tension evident in her set features. "And if there is no order," she asked, "the mission will be over. Fly back to the mount." She paused before moving to the hatch in the floor. "And be sure to meet with Madam Hackigan as soon as you return."
Chapter 37. Clay. It seemed as if half of Stockholm was already alight by the time Lutheran swept over the outer wall. Fires raged on both sides of the falls, and he could see people running through the streets on the eastern side. At first, it appeared to be the chaotic end of another city, fallen to the White's malice. But then he saw smoke plumes rising from the cannon on the ships in the harbor. To Clay's bemusement, they were firing into the eastern districts of the city, the shells falling amidst the houses closest to the rim of the crater. As Lutheran flew closer, however, he saw reds leaping from one rooftop to another, belching flame at the people running in the streets below. He saw one red blasted in half by a direct hit from a cannon shell, but there were dozens, perhaps hundreds more, still scrambling over the lip of the crater. Fortunately, it appeared none had noticed Lutheran's arrival. Clay had already filled his fist with vials of red, green, and black. He drank them all now, then glanced over his shoulder to ensure Chris was doing the same. He leaned forward, placing a hand on Lutheran's neck with the intent of guiding his attack, but the black needed no instruction tonight. Folding his wings, Lutheran angled his body in a near-vertical dive, Clay finding himself thankful for the green he had imbibed, as the slipstream might otherwise have torn his grip from the neck spines. Lutheran flared his wings and tilted back as they neared the rooftops, claws stabbing down to pierce the hide of an unsuspecting red. It struggled frantically, tail lashing at Lutheran's hide, close enough for Clay to reel away from a whip crack an inch from his ear. Lutheran clamped his jaws on the red's neck and snapped it with a swift, wrenching jerk. Rearing back from the kill, Lutheran raised his head to the sky and let out a loud, summoning roar. The great host of blacks circling above responded without hesitation, streaking out of the gloom in a dark torrent. To Clay's eyes, it seemed as if the night sky were reaching down to pour a shadow over the city. Red after red was crushed under the weight of the assault. Some tried vainly to take to the skies, only to be caught and dragged back into the tearing, rending maelstrom. The rain of black drakes swept over the upper districts, swallowing reds as it did so, then spilling over the lip of the crater to assail those still charging across the plain beyond. The mind controlling the drake assault evidently realized the danger at that point, for the sky beyond the edge of the crater suddenly became filled with reds as they abandoned their ground assault. The blacks began to take off in response, leaving behind a host of slaughtered drakes. Clay communicated to Lutheran the need to wait as he and Chris slipped from his back and hurried to a safe distance. "They're all yours, big fella," Clay told him, as Lutheran crouched, then launched himself upwards, his wings birthing a gale as he climbed into the darkness. "Come on," Clay told Chris. "We gotta find the captain." They leapt from one building to another, sailing over streets thronged with panicked people, Clay constantly searching for someone in authority. He soon happened upon a crew of firefighters, attempting to contain a blaze raging in a two-story tenement.
"Hile more,"
he said, leaping down to shout into the ear of the youth who seemed to be in charge.
"That way,"
the youngster shouted in response, pointing to another blaze burning a few streets ahead. Clay and Chris ran on, dodging past fleeing townsfolk, who as yet failed to recognize the fact that their deliverance had arrived. They rounded a corner into a small square, where Clay's gaze immediately alighted on Hylemore's unmistakable form. The captain stood over a large red, surrounded by bodies in various states of burnt dismemberment. A girl of about 18 knelt close by, face frozen and expressionless, despite the tears streaming from her eyes. As he drew closer, Clay saw that the red was still alive despite the numerous bullet holes in its hide. Its wings flapped feebly, and its claws dug into the cobbles as it sought to raise itself, and might have done so had Hylemore not raised a revolver and put a bullet through its skull.
"Captain!"
Clay called out, running to his side. Hylemore's face was grim as he glanced at Clay and offered a muttered greeting.
"Mr. Torkreek, I had hoped to see you earlier in the evening. Blacks can only fly so fast."
Watching Hylemore's gaze track over the surrounding corpses, rich in guilt, he asked,
"Friends of yours, huh?"
"The Wash Lane Defense Volunteers,"
Hylemore replied. He went to the kneeling girl, crouching to gently pull her to her feet, murmuring,
It's done, Gillette. We won. The girl closed her eyes and stepped away from him, hugging herself tight.
What did they win?
She asked in a sob, jerking her head at the bodies. Palmore had no answer for her, and she sagged a little in mingled sorrow and exhaustion.
Here,
Chris said, coming forward to take hold of the girl, offering a vial of green.
This will help.
Gillette made a faint effort to shrug her off, but allowed herself to be guided to a nearby bench, where she drank down the green. We killed the first one we found easily enough, Palmore was saying in a faint, distant voice, his gaze now fixed on the red he had shot. This one was different. Gillette tried to hold it with black, but it was just too fast. Too strong. Clay coughed, finding he didn't particularly care for this version of the captain. Much as they grated on each other, the man's unerring will and discipline had long been a source of reassurance. Palmore blinked and straightened, turning back to him. There are still greens on the other side of the falls and in the harbor, he said, holstering his revolver. They'll need to be dealt with. Our friends'll take care of it, Clay assured him. Gonna need you to make sure the folks here don't shoot at them. Think you can do that? Palmore's expression hardened into a gratifyingly familiar frown. Of course, he snapped and marched off, heading south to the harbor. We'll need help fighting these fires, he added over his shoulder, if you don't mind. The battle between red and black raged in the skies over Stockholm for nearly an hour, swift moonlit shapes soaring and diving against a backdrop of stars. Occasionally, the struggle would be illuminated by a concordance of flame. Human spectators were briefly presented with the sight of a dozen or more drakes assailing each other in a whirling knot of lashing tails and stabbing claws, before the flames died, and all became confusion once more. Drakes fell into the harbor throughout it all, trailing smoke as they plummeted down. Most were dead, but a few struggled on the surface for a time, screaming out distress calls until the water pulled them down. By dawn, all the reds appeared to have either fled or fallen, and the blacks turned their attention to the greens, still prowling the western side of the city. They swooped down in successive relays, plucking greens from the streets, crushing them with claws and teeth, before casting the bodies away and diving down for more. When sunlight crested the edge of the crater, Clay saw a steady stream of greens fleeing over the western wall. Apparently, the unseen hand that commanded them had finally allowed a retreat. In the aftermath, Stockholm lay silent under a pool of smoke. The ships sat in harbor waters painted a dull red in the meager light. There was no celebration amongst the townsfolk, no upsurge of joy in victory. Many stood or huddled together, soot-stained faces blank with shock, whilst others wandered aimlessly, staring at the blackened ruins of homes or businesses. The children were an exception, clustering around the many drake corpses and chattering in excitement as they poked them with sticks, sometimes scurrying back in delighted alarm when they twitched in response. The blacks continued to patrol the skies above the city, drawing many a concerned and wary eye. Clay had communicated to Lutheran the need to keep out of rifle range, along with a stern warning against perching in the city itself. Instead, the blacks came to rest on the walls along the crater rim, bodies turned towards the rising sun, and wings spread to catch the warmth. Captain Heilmore, seemingly immune to fatigue, organized working parties from the Superior and the merchant ships to assist in clearing the worst of the rubble from the streets and extinguishing the few remaining fires. He also enlisted the large number of harvesters in the port to extract product from the bountiful supply of corpses littering the streets and the surrounding country, raising a somewhat problematic question in the process.
We'll need it, Hylemore said. This war isn't over, Mr. Torkreek, as you well know. Clay looked at the corpse of the Black lying on the eastern quayside. It was an adult female, some 20 feet long, congealed blood covering the wounds in her hide from numerous red-tail strikes. There were others to be found in the city and the harbor waters, a valuable resource to Hylemore's eyes. In truth, Clay wasn't sure how the Blacks would react to the harvesting of their dead. Whilst he was well aware of their capacity for grief, unlike humans, they didn't seem inclined to keen over the corpses of their kin. Perhaps they don't need to, he thought. The memories get passed on, leaving the flesh behind, empty and dead. Lutheran seemed indifferent to the matter, his mind preoccupied with scouring the surrounding country for more enemies. Even so, Clay thought it best not to risk antagonizing their allies unnecessarily. Do it undercover, he told Hylemore. And tonight, lessen the chance of their seeing. Hylemore called a conference aboard the Superior that evening, where he gave a reckoning of the losses suffered and damage done. Altogether, over 400 people had perished in the fighting, with double that number injured, most of the casualties having been inflicted by the Reds. Although Hylemore spoke with his usual brisk authority, Clay could see the guilt behind his eyes. Could have been a lot worse, Captain, he told him, heralding a murmur of muted agreement from the others present. Captain O'Canis had come, along with Captain Tidlow, as representative of the merchant fleet. There was also the blood-blessed girl from the square, still somewhat pale of face, and a chunky youth in a contractor's duster Clay doubted he had any right to wear. These two represented the Vota rebels, who had apparently been engaged in a minor civil war with a young woman in a partially scorched military uniform, facing them across the wardroom table. To Clay's eyes, it didn't appear that the previous night's events had done much to heal the rift betwixt the two groups.
With the danger averted,
the young woman, Kulvetch, said when Hylemore fell silent,
my people are keen to return to their homes.
Who says it's averted?
Cole, the chunky youth, returned.
Plenty of Drake still out there.
This city now enjoys a very special form of protection,
Kulvetch replied, casting a meaningful glance at Clay. This fleet will be sailing for Verestia once the harvesting is complete, Hylemore said. Whatever dispositions you wish to make after that are a matter for you.
You just gonna leave us?
Cole asked. I have discussed the matter with Mr. Torkreek, Hylemore replied. He will consult with our allies, requesting that they leave a third of their number here to ward off future attacks.
There are those of us, Gillette said, who don't want to stay here anymore. What about them?
What?
Cole demanded, but she ignored him, keeping her gaze on Hylemore. We can't take children, he said, or anyone not of fighting age. We're sailing into battle after all.
Then I want to volunteer, she said,
continuing to ignore the glowering reaction of her fellow voter.
And there are plenty more who think like me. The real war needs fighting, and it isn't here.
Very well, Hylemore said, turning to Kulvetch. Colonel? Any volunteers from your side of the falls?
Forget it, Captain,
Cole said as Kulvetch hesitated.
She's just itching for you to leave with our best fighters so she can finally take the whole city.
Kulvetch's indecision faded abruptly, and she straightened into a military bearing.
I will volunteer. Also, I've little doubt my Marines will follow me.
And they would be very welcome, Hylemore said, turning back to Cole. As for those who remain, I recommend concentrating your forces in the east side and doing everything you can to fortify the outer wall. He stepped back from the table. Harvesting is expected to be complete within 2 days. Please be prepared to sail by then. He nodded and started towards the door.
You think we're just going to let you sail off with our best fighters?
Cole demanded, moving to stand in his way.
Our committee answers to the voters' rights
He fell silent as Hylmore's fist slammed into the center of his face. Cole's head snapped back, and he fell to all fours, blood streaming from a broken nose.
I have had enough of your infantile politics,
Hylmore said, very precisely.
After all your people suffered last night, you still seek to play your games. Were you a member of my crew, I would have you shot. In fact...
Clay stepped forward as Hylmore's hand went to his revolver.
I think that's meeting adjourned, folks,
Clay said cheerfully, crouching to drag Cole to his feet and pushing him towards the door. Nice coat, he said, as he hustled him from the room. Where'd you get it?
Here,
Clay said, entering the cabin Chris shared with Lauriabeth. He hadn't knocked, but she didn't seem to mind.
Got your present.
He set the duster alongside her on the bunk. She had been sitting with her knees drawn up, in silent contemplation of the vial of synthetic product. His cousin wasn't present, which she didn't find surprising. She and Lieutenant Sigarol hadn't been seen much since they returned to the ship.
It's got blood on it,
Chris observed, casting a brief glance over the duster.
Fresh blood.
Nobody died, don't worry. And it'll wash.
I thought only members of your profession wore these.
Fellow who had it before didn't deserve it. Reckon you've earned it. He sat himself on the bunk and rested his back against the bulkhead, suddenly weary. It occurred to him that neither of them had slept for close on 2 days.
I'm honored,
Chris said, a tone vague but genuine. She turned her gaze back to the vial, her other hand gripping the crystal shard about her neck.
Still tempted, huh?
Clay asked her.
I have to know, Clay,
she said, slipping into her own language.
Given what we're about to sail into, there might not be another chance.
We already know a lot of it, he pointed out. One of the whites you bred got free somehow. Zembi got spoiled, and Hezki flew off to Aratzia in the aerostat.
He wanted me to know,
she insisted, holding up the crystal so the light from the porthole caught its myriad facets.
There's knowledge in here. Important knowledge.
Or a trap. He was spoiled, remember? And he did try to kill you.
Part of him was still there, deep inside. I know it. Perhaps...
She gripped the crystal tighter.
In here, also.
She's already decided, he realized, seeing the resolve on her face. Short of tying her up, there wasn't much he could do to stop her.
Well, if you have to,
he said, shifting to face her. But we do this together. You ain't going in there on your own. Chris seemed about to argue, but then swallowed a sigh and nodded. They sat facing each other on the bunk, Clay seeing how she had to still the tremble in her fingers before she could remove the stopper from the vial. She unhooked the crystal from the chain about her neck and set it down on the bunk between them.
Ready?
She asked, vial poised before her lips.
No, but as you're gonna do it anyway.
A smile ghosted across her lips and she drank, taking in perhaps a third of the vial's contents. The reaction was immediate, Chris stiffening with a sharp intake of breath. The vial slipped from her fingers, and Clay's hand darted forward to catch it before it spilled.
Chris?
He asked, receiving no response. She sat in rigid silence, eyes wide open, but he knew they saw nothing. Clay blinked as something flashed. Looking down, he saw the crystal shard pulsing with light, slow at first, but the rhythm building rapidly until it emitted a constant bluish light. Clay returned the stopper to the vial and focused his gaze on Chris's blank face, finding the focus needed to summon the blueless trance. It was different than before, Clay finding himself floating in a place without sensation. There was no ground beneath his feet, and no air on his skin. The images he saw seemed to play out at a remove, like watching a play. Chris stood in the chamber where they had found the ruined stone eggs, the place that had become the tomb of her fellow ancient blood-blessed. When Clay had come here, it had been a dark, dust-covered mess of rubble, but now it was brightly lit by the crystal floating above the sleeping chambers. He watched Chris move to each of the chambers, a hand playing over the stone surfaces. "All the kids are still asleep, I guess," he said, receiving no response. He called out to her, but she didn't seem to hear as she continued her inspection of the giant eggs. Repeated attempts proved similarly fruitless, forcing him to conclude he would have to resign himself to the role of spectator rather than participant. He saw Chris start as the crystal flickered, stepping back from the chamber at the sound of grinding stone. The egg-shaped mass to her left began to come apart, leaking fluid over the floor. A naked figure tumbled out as the object became fully segmented. It was a young man, tall and lean, the light from the crystal gleaming on his athletic frame as he slowly rose to his feet.
"Heskey," Chris said, involuntarily reaching out to him.
However, this memory appeared both deaf and blind to her presence. His face, a handsome adult version of the boy she had once tutored in the Philos enclave, was set in a preoccupied frown, his eyes constantly blinking and lips moving in a silent mutter. After a slight pause, he returned to the segmented chamber and retrieved a set of sodden clothes, dressing rapidly, then bent to recover a belt holding four flasks. Donning the belt, Heskey moved to the exit, then stopped, shaking his head as if in confusion. Then, slowly, he turned back and raised his gaze to the crystal hanging above the sleeping chambers.
"Don't!"
Clay heard Chris say in a gasp, but of course Heskey couldn't hear her. Taking one of the flasks from his belt, he took a hefty gulp and concentrated his gaze on the crystal. It began to emit the tinkling that told of being subjected to black, but instead of being refashioned into a sculpture, it spun violently in the air and let out a loud crack. The light bathing the stone eggs flickered and died, the crystal tumbling to the floor along with the chambers, each one birthing a loud boom as they toppled and rolled. Clay heard Chris let out a sob, rich in the kind of despair and grief he remembered from his last visit here. Then she had seen proof of the deaths of her companions. Now she had been forced to witness their murder. He wanted to say something to her, reach through the invisible veil separating them to offer comfort. Even the most empty, awkward expression of consolation would have been preferable to impotently witnessing her anguish. But, try as he might, the veil proved impenetrable, and he could only watch her stagger, sobbing after Heskey as he made his way from the chamber. The memory blurred and accelerated then, Clay catching only glimpses of the rapid melange of images that followed. Heskey making his way through the mountains to the cliff face covered in wooden scaffolding, taking two eggs from the terraces at the base of the cavernous chamber within, drinking more product, red this time, and bathing both eggs in heat before retreating to a safe distance. The memory slowed when the eggs hatched, bursting apart like bombs. When the smoke cleared, two infant white drakes sat amidst the shattered shells, chirping as they nuzzled each other. Heskey approached to crouch nearby, and they leapt into his arms, wings flapping in excitement. Seeing how Heskey nodded in response, Clay realized he had seen his expression before. "Silverpin," he thought. he's their Silverpin. They were able to call to him even from within the egg.
Heskey gave another nod and set the two infants down before moving to the row of crystals, drinking from one of his flasks as he did so. A short pause, and then the blue crystal began to glow, growing brighter as it rose from the chamber floor. Heskey spread his arms out wide as the crystal emitted a pulse of light bright enough to swamp the vision. When the light faded, Heskey had collapsed to his knees, shuddering. Seeing the light play over the scales on his back, Clay knew what he would see before Heskey raised his face. The yellow eyes, the ridged brows, the spines. The first ever spoiled, he thought. The memory blurred again, the images racing by with dizzying speed, too fast for Clay to catch. When it slowed again, Heskey stood over the wet, naked form of an old man. Beyond them, a segmented sleeping chamber hovered in the air below a glowing crystal. The two infant whites snapped at the old man as he slowly heaved himself up, raising his gaze to regard Heskey's deformed visage.
"I grew tired of your prison, father," Heskey told him. "I have been offered freedom and a whole world to play in."
Zembi's gaze went to the two drakes. They hissed in response, one lashing out with its tail to score a cut into the old man's arm.
"The eggs,"
Zembi groaned, his head sagging.
"We should have destroyed the eggs."
"Yes," Heskey agreed.
"But you didn't. They called to me for centuries, father. Though I fought them, tried to resist their enticements, the many dreams they planted in my mind. When the promises didn't work, they made their dreams into nightmares. But a free mind can wake from a nightmare, and I was not free. For year after year, I suffered. And then a very important question occurred to me. Why?"
Heskey crouched in front of the old man, speaking softly.
"Why suffer so much for a man who gave me so little?" "You're insane," Zembi told him. "They drove you mad." "They set me free,"
Heskey corrected in a chiding tone.
"Guided me to the facet within the crystal that would unlock the sarcophagus. No longer would I live according to your whim or Krizel's."
Zembi's head snapped up at this, eyes bright with alarm and anger.
"Oh, don't worry," Heskey told him. "I intend to leave her very much alive. One day she'll wake."
He rose and stood back, gesturing at the blue crystal which floated close by.
"And find you waiting for her."
The blue crystal flared into life, Zembi letting out a short, pain-filled cry that soon choked into a strangled gurgle. When the light faded, the old man remained on the floor, convulsing. To Clay, it appeared as if the scales on his back were only partially formed, his hands twisting into claws, then back again.
"He's fighting it," Clay realized.
"A parting gift,"
Heskey went on, moving to the blue crystal. He drank from one of his flasks and focused his gaze. A tinkling sound rose as one of the crystal's spikes separated from the core and floated into Hezky's hand. He stared at the shard for a moment of intense concentration, a faint light flaring, then fading within.
"Perhaps you'll kill her,"
he went on, returning to Zembi.
"Or she'll kill you. In which case, I should very much like her to know. She can think about it, for however long it takes her to grow old and die down here."
He opened his hand, offering the shard to Zembi. The old man's face was contorting now, ridges swelling on his forehead, gritted teeth elongating. It would only be seconds before the transformation was complete,
Clay heard Kriz let out a surprised yelp as Zembi's hand shot out to grasp the shard, then stab it into Hezki's chest. The younger man shouted in pain and shock, reeling away, the shard falling free as he did so. He staggered back, blood leaking from the wound. The two infant wights set upon Zembi, biting at his flesh in a fury, then stopping abruptly and scurrying back. Zembi slowly rose to his full height, remade features now firmly in place, a fully converted spoiled.
"You vicious old bastard!"
Hezki railed at him, hand clutched over his bleeding chest. But the insults were wasted now, for Zembi replied with only an incurious glance. Hezki let out a grunt of impotent fury, then reached for another flask, drinking the entire contents in a few urgent gulps.
"It's not healing right,"
he said in an aggrieved whimper, casting a desperate gaze at the two wights.
"The bleeding stopped, but it's not healed. I can feel it."
The two infants let out an identical hiss, and his mouth clamped shut. Hezki stood frozen in place as the wights turned their gaze on Zembi. He blinked and turned back to the sleeping chamber, climbing inside, whereupon it closed around him once more. The wights issued a brief squawk, and Hezki shuddered. The memory faded into a grey void as he started towards the rear of the chamber in an agonized stumble, with the wights scurrying close behind.
"You were right."
Clay blinked and found himself back in the cabin. Kriz sat before him, face downcast and tears falling onto the blankets.
"It was a trap,"
she went on in a whisper.
"I should have left it be."
"We learned some things we didn't know before," Clay said, reaching out to cup her face, thumbing the tears away. "Hezki flew them to Aratzia, but his wound must have killed him on the way and the aerostat crashed in Crystalline Lake. Sad to say the wights didn't drown with him. Somehow they made it out, made their way to the enclave, and started making eggs. In time they had a big enough brood to start their war."
"It doesn't help us," she said. "There was nothing there beyond malice. My brothers need to hurt me."
"Not true," Clay said, pulling her closer. "You saw Zembi fight it. We know from Miss Lethbridge there were once free spoiled here. If they can be freed..." His words died as she kissed him. It was a long kiss, after which she drew back and glanced at the door.
"Your cousin isn't coming back soon, is she?"
"I doubt it." Kriz turned back to him, hands moving to unbutton her shirt.
"Good."
Chapter 38. Cirrus. He could feel Kathleen's mingled terror and anger as he made the suggestion that the surviving greens and reds should scatter. She had called him to her command tent to oversee the assault on Stockholm. Given that it was an all-Drake affair, she would act as conduit whilst Cirrus supplied the tactical direction. Linking minds with her was always a disconcerting experience, like sinking into a constantly shifting swamp of muted emotion, whilst beneath it all the vast will of the white rumbled and smoked like a fractious volcano. Cirrus couldn't help a perverse pride in both the conception and execution of his plan, making him ponder the unwelcome notion that he might have absorbed some of Moradin's characteristics. His opponent at Stockholm had evidently been a capable commander. The booby traps and the mines in the harbor were an unpleasant and costly surprise, as was the fierce resistance of the ships. But he had learned by now that it was always a sound strategy to subvert the expectations of one's enemy. In compelling the Reds to mount a ground assault rather than attack from the air, he had done exactly that. Victory would undoubtedly have been his had not the blacks arrived. After hours of hopeless resistance, during which Kathleen's mind continued to communicate the death agonies of hundreds of drakes, Cirrus had been forced to withdraw from their shared connection.
"We can't win this," he said simply. "If he wishes to preserve their lives, they should scatter."
Her red-black eyes bore into him with such intensity, he wondered if she had suddenly decided to hate him. But then she reached out to capture his mind once more, and he realized her expression was born of concern rather than hatred. For the first time, he was able to fully experience her communion with the White. There were no words, no shared images, just an exchange of emotion so rapid it sent a jolt of pain through his mind. Somehow, despite the pain, he was able to discern the essence of this communication. Failure, reproach, contrition, anger, deeper contrition, need to punish, acceptance, and supplication. For a brief moment, he managed to make out a coherent thought, as Kathleen ensured her message was unambiguous.
"He is still needed. My failure. My punishment."
There was no pause before the White responded. "Concurrence." Cirrus let out a groan as Kathleen released her mental hold, seeing her offer him a sad smile and a shrug.
"This time, he would have killed you," she said.
Abruptly, she stiffened, arching like a bow, limbs shuddering as her head snapped back. Her body was so rigid she couldn't even fall from her chair. Cirrus forced himself to watch as she convulsed, blood spouting from her mouth and streaming from her nose, the sudden appearance of more blood beneath her chair indicating she was bleeding from all orifices. It continued for what seemed an age, so long in fact that her finely tailored cavalry uniform became drenched in blood, and Cirrus felt certain she would soon have no more left to give. The notion raised an important question. If she dies, what then? But she didn't die. Finally, when her skin had taken on an alabaster hue, and the blood had begun to pool on the carpet, she collapsed. Cirrus leapt forward to catch her as she fell, lifting her easily in his remade arms. Kathleen's eyelids fluttered as she shivered in his grasp, her lips forming a smile as she raised a hand to caress his scaled cheek.
"My hero,"
she whispered before fainting. There were few foothills north of the pass known as the Grand Cut, the mountains rearing up out of the grassy plains in sudden, sheer-sided majesty. The pass itself was a broad canyon that narrowed considerably as it proceeded deeper into the range of peaks dominating the region the Verestians called the Neck. Reconnaissance flights by Reds the day before had confirmed the smaller passes to the east and west closed by rubble. The Grand Cut, however, remained open.
"An obvious trap," Moradin growled, squinting at the pass and the clouds lingering over the cliffs that formed its flanks. "Expected better of them."
"You're sure?"
Kathleen asked. She had recovered quickly from the previous night's punishment, color having returned to her face and her bearing displaying scant sign of fatigue. Cirrus detected a new wariness in her, however. In place of her ruined uniform, she wore a simple muslin dress, a thick woolen shawl about her shoulders, which was slightly hunched. He also noted the tightness of her grip on the shawl, the knuckles bone white.
"We go in there, we'll pay for it," Moradin asserted. "In blood."
Kathleen raised an eyebrow at Cirrus, letting out an exasperated hiss when he gave a nod of confirmation.
"Very well," she said, turning away. "The scenic route, it is."
She trailed off as a loud boom sounded from the Grand Cut. Turning back, Cirrus saw a large grey cloud rising above the mountain mist, followed a second later by a thick pall of dust issuing from the mouth of the pass.
"What was that?"
Kathleen demanded. Moradin's brows knitted in bemusement as he raised a spyglass to scan the pass.
"Looks as if they've blocked it anyway," he said when the dust had cleared.
He continued to peer through the glass, then straightened in surprise.
"Or at least tried to. Bloody thing's still open."
Cirrus extended his own glass and trained it on the grand cut. Moradin was right. There was a good deal of rubble littering the floor of the pass, but it was far from blocked.
"Miscalculated their charge, perhaps," Moradin said as he and Cirrus exchanged glances. "Or blew themselves up trying to rig it."
"It could still be a trap," Cirrus said. "Bait to lure us in."
"The Reds will find out soon enough,"
Kathleen said. A trio of Reds flew overhead a few seconds later, wings sweeping in broad arcs as they climbed into the mist. Kathleen shared the view through the eyes of the lead Red as it flew over the pass.
"As I thought,"
Moradin commented in satisfaction, at the sight of numerous armed figures dotting the rocky terrain atop the cliffs. Cirrus estimated their number at 300 at most, hardly the kind of force he would have expected if their enemy intended to inflict serious harm.
"Unless they want the pass to do it for them," Moradin mused, reading his thoughts. "Wait until we march in, then bring the mountains down on top of us."
A pulse of grim amusement.
"Looks like they pissed on their own breakfast with this one."
"It could still..." Cirrus began, but his thought was swallowed by a sudden upsurge of excitement from Kathleen.
"She's here!"
The Red's vision of the pass sprang into more vivid life, focusing on a particular figure standing at the cliff edge. Thanks to the power of Drake sight, they were soon confronted with a close-up view of the figure's features. Bazan Lethbridge stared back at them through the Red's eyes, a smile of grim mockery on her lips. She moved slightly, and the image refocused, drawing back to reveal the sight of her raising a carbine to her shoulder. The muzzle flared in a bright orange plume, and the vision went black. The absence of the usual confusion and pain indicated the Red had died instantly.
"Bitch!"
Kathleen breathed in a tone of hungry malice. Her gaze flashed at Cirrus and Moradin, the Red pupils seeming to glow like coals.
"Get in there! Send all of them!"
Her will was implacable and shot through with the White's irresistible bloodlust. Every Red leapt into the sky as the spoiled battalions started forward. The Greens charged in two huge packs on the flanks, every mind, spoiled and Drake, filled with a single purpose.
Kill her!
Chapter 39. Lizanne. The smoker jerked against her shoulder as she unleashed the Red ball. It impacted at the base of the Red's neck, the explosion instantly severing it from the body. The rest of the fighters, all armed with smokers, opened fire on the other Reds. The hail of explosive bullets felled one immediately, but it took several more shots before they brought down the other, the bullets chasing it across the sky until one of the Verestians managed a hit on its chest. Bazan watched the stricken creature spiral down into the misty depths of the Grand Cut, then turned her gaze to the north. She found that the fog, mingled with the drifting smoke from their intentionally abortive attempt to block the pass, made it difficult to gauge the reaction of the White's army. She injected a small amount of product to enhance her vision, and was soon rewarded with the sight of a multitude of green drakes streaming towards the cut. Following close behind were the spoiled, their previously neat ranks forgotten now, as they charged across the plain in a disorderly mob thousands strong. Shifting her gaze upwards, she saw the fast-approaching shapes of more Reds than could easily be counted. In addition to the blood-blessed contingent, there are about 200 Varestian fighters, mostly of a piratical nature, judging by their clothing and abundance of knives. They were all volunteers who had been dropped on the lower south-facing slopes by Aerostat the day before.
"They're coming," she told them. "Remember your orders. Fire and retreat. We need to draw them in."
The Varestians immediately ran off to occupy their positions deeper in the pass, the group on the other side of the dividing chasm following suit, leaving the Bloodblessed to face the first rush of Reds. Lizanne injected a short burst of blue and slipped into the trance where Morvel was waiting on the deck of the antique sailing ship that formed her mindscape.
"It worked," Lizanne told her. "Tell Takela to commence her run."
She ended the trance without waiting for a reply and moved back from the cliff edge.
"Product!"
Lizanne ordered the other Bloodblessed, depressing the first three buttons on her spider.
"Full doses! No need to skimp here! Everyone we kill today is one we don't have to kill tomorrow."
She moved to crouch behind a nearby boulder, the other Bloodblessed also finding cover in the surrounding rocks. Lizanne rested the smoker's forestock on the top of the boulder, pointing it at the sky, and slotted another Red Bull into the glass receptacle atop the chamber. She waited, veins thrumming with product and eyes fixed on the smoker's sights. She heard the Reds before she saw them, their shrill cries echoing up the mountainside in a hungry chorus. She lit the Red Bull the instant a dark silhouette slipped into her sights, blasting it apart as a cacophony of carbine fire erupted all around. Lizanne stood up, seeing a dozen Reds falling out of the sky as the explosive rounds took their toll. Seeing a Red twisting amidst the barrage, she tracked it with the smoker, sights aimed just in front of its nose to compensate for the distance, and fired three rounds in quick succession, the carbine's lever blurring as she worked it. Mortally wounded by the trio of large holes punched into its hide, the Red let out a stream of impotent flame before slamming into the cliff face below. A warning shout from one of her fellow Bloodblessed had Lizanne leaping away, green enhanced limbs carrying her wide of the stream of fire cast at her by a diving Red. It reared back, wings fanning the air and neck coiling for another try. A salvo of rounds from the surrounding Bloodblessed tore one of its wings away and left a gaping hole in its chest, leaving it a bloody tangle clinging feebly to the cliff edge before sliding into the grand cut. Casting a glance skyward, Lizanne saw that the Reds had been forced higher by the fire of the smokers and were now circling in a huge spiral. Seeing them begin to cluster together in groups of five or more, Lizanne knew that the defenders were about to be subjected to a massed onslaught from above. No amount of explosive bullets could hope to stem such a weight of drake flesh.
"Pull back!"
she shouted, moving across the rocky ground in an unnaturally fast, leaping sprint. Seeing their prey attempting an escape, the Reds let out a collective scream of fury and gave chase. Hearing the beat of large wings at her back, Lizanne leapt and pivoted in midair, aiming the smoker one-handed at the head of the pursuing Red. Thanks to the reflex-enhancing effects of green, she was able to put a bullet in its eye before whirling about for a landing. She didn't pause as her boots met rock, propelling herself on and refreshing her diminishing green with the spider. A scream sounded behind her, human rather than Drake, brief and full of agony before it choked off. Lizanne didn't turn to see the inevitable grisly spectacle. She had entertained a faint hope of completing this mission without casualties, but knew it to be an indulgent self-delusion, designed to assuage the guilt of commanding others in battle. Upon reaching a point halfway along the pass, she leapt atop a tall boulder and came to a halt, turning to face the Reds. The other Bloodblessed all rushed to pre-chosen spots and did the same, all smokers raised and aimed as the Reds closed. Here the pass constricted to its narrowest point and was overlooked by ledges on the mountains rising on both sides, ledges where their pirate allies now waited, smokers tracking the reds streaming into their sights. Over 200 carbines.